Welcome to another podcast episode of UN Health Scotland series, Connecting Women's Voices on Climate Justice, Perspectives from Scotland and Around the World. My name is Grace Broad and I am a university student and intern with UN Health Scotland on the Gender and Climate team. I'm very excited to facilitate this discussion today between two incredible women who continue to work and progress within the water development and water security industries, predominantly within sub-Saharan Africa. First, I'd like to introduce water specialist, researcher and facilitator, Dr. Kirsten Dannert. With over 20 years experience in water development, Kirsten has worked within sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. Kirsten is currently working and living in Switzerland as director for Ask for Water. I would also like to introduce Fadzaiti Mandawafa, who is a water coordinator for the NGO ADRA. She has an advisory role in all WASH projects, which surrounds water supply and sanitation work. Having studied at the University of Zimbabwe, Fadzai continues to live and work on local projects there. So hello both, how are you doing today?
Good, no, really good, really excited to be here. It's lovely to be doing something back with Scotland, again in Scotland. So I'm really happy. Thank you, Grace.
Fadzai, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Grace. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to you and share my experiences.
Perfect. Thank you. I'll start with my first question. So first of all, I'd like to ask both of you, what motivated you to seek a career within the water development and sanitation industries? So Kirsten, we'll go to you first.
Thanks a lot, Grace, for the question. I mean, my motivation goes right back to when I was 17. And did a trip which was part of the Duke of Edinburgh, the late Duke of Edinburgh, Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme to India. And it was a trip we were hosted by Rotarians in Delhi and stayed with them and moved around a little bit in the Golden Triangle of India. Mm-hmm. And what struck me was just a massive cultural difference from what I was used to coming from Edinburgh. And the incredible hospitality of people. Mm-hmm. And I was appalled by the poverty, just absolutely appalled by what I saw. And so that really motivated me to want to do something working on poverty reduction. And then I wanted to go back to India. So it was real poverty culture, hospitality that okay. catapulted me into the water sector. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So after you got into that sector, how did you move from the poverty sector to water sanitation more specifically?
I went after finishing school, I went and studied mechanical engineering at Strathclyde in Glasgow, then went to Germany on an Erasmus exchange program and worked for a while in Germany in an IT sector, actually. Mm-hmm. But my heart, having had that experience in India, my heart was still really in overseas work. And so I looked for master's programs and returned to the UK to Cranfield University and did a master's in community water supplies for developing countries. And that was really the beginning of my entry into the water sector. Yeah. Thank you.
And Fadzai, how about you? What motivated you to join this industry of work?
Okay, for me, it really started as a young lady. I grew up in an urban setting. Mm-hmm. And as we grew, it was, I think when I was much younger, we had water, right, tap water, and we never had challenges with water. And as the years went by in my secondary school, we started facing challenges in terms of access to water. Council water wasn't available anymore. And the only other alternative was borehole water. And drilling boreholes was not something that we could afford as a family. So we'd then go from house to house, getting water for us to be able to drink, to do all the things that you need, the domestic use of water. And, you know, we would have to go from this household and then the next day you go to a different household so that you don't bother them that much. Mm-hmm. So it was such a struggle to get water. You had to limit your use of water, and you had to be pushing a wheelbarrow each and every day to just get access to water. So this is what actually inspired me to get into the water sector.
So it was a very personal experience that led
it
you
was.
So could you both explain the process of the water projects that you're both working on or currently working on, and how these projects have moved from their planning stages to the installation and monitoring of these water and sanitation systems? So Fadzai, I'll go to you first.
All right, so
big question.
Yeah, it is. So the work I do, firstly, I will speak about drilling. So as an organization, there is a drilling rig, and so I manage the drilling rig. So we drill boreholes all over the country. So it's actually the logistics and management of the whole enterprise of borehole drilling. And then in addition, we also have wash projects where we create or rehabilitate water sources. So these can be either manually equipped or solar powered. And then we also do hygiene promotion and sanitation services within the country. So how the process starts is it's proposal development. So you go through all the research and needs assessment that you actually have to go through and develop a proposal. Having done that, once you get the grant, then you can start working on the project. So when it comes to access to water, it starts right from geosurveys to the drilling of the boreholes, equipping them, capacity tests, water quality tests, and finally having a product. Mm-hmm. And then we also have the process of implementing the software side of water, which would be your hygiene promotion and sanitation services. So here you are encouraging people to do the right thing in terms of hygiene. Sometimes we take for granted the aspects of hygiene, like in the current COVID situation, we take for granted hand washing, wearing of masks. So it then involves all that, trying to change people's behaviors through hygiene promotion and sanitation services.
And would you say hygiene promotion is the most crucial area that you probably work within?
I wouldn't say it's the most crucial area, but under the current circumstances, then yes, we really need to encourage people to hand wash and be able to provide the hand washing facilities for them to be able to do that. In rural settings, you would be also encouraging people to have hand washing stations that are made from local materials.
Okay.
So that's what we do. I wouldn't say it's really the crucial part, but every single part of the wash sector is as important, because mm-hmm. we can promote hygiene, but without water, then it's
yes.
you can't go ahead and do hygiene promotion. So one of the key things is actually access to water.
Mm-hmm. It almost works as though a cycle, isn't it? It's kind of all
exactly
into each other. Kirsten, could you also please explain the projects that you currently work on?
Great, thanks a lot, Grace. So when I lived and worked in Uganda, quite a lot of my work was about trying to test and introduce new technologies into context. So we worked in projects that were trying to develop low-cost drilling technology, so bringing the cost down by using manual techniques. And there, even what's very important also in testing a new technology is the involvement of the community. You can't just go somewhere and test. It really needs to be acceptable to the local government, to the local stakeholders, and people need to understand that testing equipment may mean it can work and or not work. So the other aspect of my work also in Uganda was, again, bringing in new technology. I did work on rainwater harvesting, which was in people living, particularly in the hilly areas of Uganda, it was quite difficult to access water cheaply. So there it was trying to introduce technologies to catch the rain from the roof and make water available at home.
Mm-hmm.
And now living in Switzerland, I do a lot of work really trying to produce guidance and provide training materials. And I think a little bit like when you take a new technology to test it and try to develop it, when you're developing guidance materials and training, it's very important to contextualize that for the context. Mm-hmm. So it's not something abstract. So for example, doing even training on supervising drilling, mm-hmm. it's important to understand the in-country mechanisms and rules and laws that they have to work towards or procurement procedures. So yeah, kind of a couple of the aspects that are important for the work that I do. Thanks.
Definitely. I also wanted to touch upon this, that it's so clear that extreme drought continues in sub-Saharan Africa, where both of you have worked. And access to water remains a huge challenge for the African continent. This is closely linked to the United Nations SDG 6, clean water and sanitation. What successes do you feel there's been so far in working towards this sustainable development goal? And what more needs to be done in order to achieve this? So I'll go to you first, Kirsten.
Okay, thank you. So I think there have been tremendous improvements. If you look at the data going back to 1990, there are many more people with access to a safe drinking water supply than there were in the past. So it's definitely improving. Mm-hmm. However, there's a number of issues. And one is the rural-urban gap, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. So out of all the people that don't have access to a safe drinking water supply, 8 out of 10 of those live in rural areas. So the rural areas are really lagging. Mm-hmm. The other issue that's lagging is sanitation. So sanitation and hygiene are lagging behind drinking water. So where somebody may have a hand pump or a hand pump borehole to fetch water, they may not have any way of depositing of their feces, or their sanitation facilities may be very poor. They may still be defecating in the open. And the other issue, I think, where we as a sector, that those people working in the sector have a long way to go, is looking at the sustainability of services. Mm-hmm. It's one thing drilling a borehole, installing a hand pump, developing a pump service. It's another thing making sure that that service is maintained and financed and run. So I think there's a huge way to go to sustain services. And also there are particular communities that are really left behind. Okay. I was just talking yesterday with somebody and they were sharing experiences of parts of Zambia where only 17% of people have access to a safe drinking water supply. So there are pockets of people either in their geographic areas or particular groups that have really been left behind, and a huge amount needs to be done to help those areas, groups have access to water, sanitation and hygiene.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, so for water, We indeed, like Kirsten has said, have made tremendous strides in trying to achieve the goal of clean water and sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
In sub-Saharan, I think most of the countries have now turned to rely on groundwater resources for drinking water supply, especially in the rural community. So there has been a lot of drilling that has gone on into in the sub-Saharan countries. So we've got a lot of boreholes that are there, and they're improving our access to water. But I think what still needs to be done is the service level. I think we need to improve our service levels, from the hand pumps to going to a tap and being able to open a tap and getting water. So that's one of the weaknesses I see as something that we actually need to work on. And in addition, I think one of the things that we haven't really done is to monitor our water resources. A lot of drilling is going on, but to be able to go back and say, this aquifer, how long are we able to get this amount of water? How can we sustain our water resources? That's quite something that is limiting in sub-Saharan Africa, and we really need to work on it. Otherwise, we'll wake up one day and realize that we really have depleted our water resources, and we'll then have wars over water, really.
Mm-hmm. And do you think this comes back to, first of all, the planning of these water pumps and drills, or is it after they've been put there, how they're maintained?
It's both. Mm-hmm. We have to know where we are drilling. Do we continue to drill more boreholes in one area, mm-hmm. such that we are over-abstracting the water? And then it goes to after drilling. Now that we've drilled, how much water are we abstracting in the water, in the borehole? How much water is in the aquifer? Can we afford to keep abstracting this amount of water? Has the aquifer significantly depleted? Is it recharging? So it's all those factors that need to be considered.
Yes, definitely, definitely. So the COP26 conference is taking place later this year, and it's going to be critical in shaping our future plans and goals in tackling the climate catastrophe. Why is water such an important factor for us to focus on at this conference, and how could this best be highlighted? Fadzai, what are your thoughts on that?
So for me, from my perspective, one of the greatest resources that are actually affected by climate change is water. So you've got your droughts that are then affecting our water resources. So it's affected in quality and in quantity. Mm-hmm. So we have either a reduced, or we have more water, but then the more water ends up being floods. When we have little water, then we don't have enough water for domestic use or even for productive use. Mm-hmm. And then it's also affected in terms of quality. So when we have more droughts, we're prone to have more pollution going through into our water resources. So I think this is why we would have water would be key in terms of looking at it in climate change. And water has a ripple effect. It's not just about water and having it, but it also affects health, it affects nutrition, it affects food security. So it's at the center of a lot of activities. So it's important that we really look at tackling issues around water and climate change. And then a writer once said, the next wars we're going to fight are going to be over water. So if the water issues are really not resolved, they are bound to bring about huge conflicts. And we'll stop fighting over resources like minerals, but we'll then be fighting over water because we wouldn't have managed it well, looking also at the climate that's really changing. So we really need to look at the management of our water resources, and this should be one of the highlights of the COP26.
Thank you. Thank you. And Kirsten, your thoughts on this as well?
Yeah, I think Fadzai's covered it beautifully, actually. I mean, I think for COP, it's the importance of understanding the resource. And if we can understand the resource through monitoring, through assessments, then it's possible to think about managing the resource. But of course, managing resource also relates to governance and who has priority, who has power. And, you know, for example, small scale farming is extremely important for livelihoods in most of sub-Saharan Africa. And so looking at water allocation, you know, what water is allocated to farmer, what emphasis goes on to drilling, or, for example, onto industry or onto the mining sector. So this whole kind of cascade of understanding, managing, governing, allocating, so that there's equitable access. Mm-hmm. And a conversation with a wonderful colleague of mine, you know, she pointed out that there's a human right to safe drinking water that's there enshrined in international law, but there's not a human right to water for agriculture, but particularly for small-scale farmers, or for any farmers, but for small-scale farmers in this context of climate change, they need to be using more water, conserving water differently. And so, without water, there's no livelihood, there's no food. So human rights to water, human rights to food are very closely related within agriculture.
And as you said, one completely affects the other.
Mm-hmm.
So they should be both held in the same respect.
Yeah. And I think another really important aspect is populations are increasing, mm-hmm. economic development is changing, and that's also happening alongside climate change, and that has huge implications. And the point that Fadzai made about conflict around, it's already happened. There are already parts of the subcontinent where there are conflicts, natural resource conflicts, mm-hmm. and that really needs to be thought through as to how to mitigate the conflicts and really have an equitable allocation of water.
Thank you both. I think that's so poignant, and COP26 is such a huge opportunity to really express this to people in continents that perhaps do not have the same issues regarding clean water and sanitation. And I think for this to become resolved, it's something we all must acknowledge.
I think just kind of a phrase that comes to mind is, you know, we shouldn't just be exploiters of water. We as human societies should be custodians of the environment and of water. So how can, you know, what could COP do to turn us from exploiters into custodians?
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant point. Thank you. I think it's so lovely how you both met. So Fadzai and Kirsten, you both connected through a global mentorship program that was hosted by the Rural Water Supply Network. So how did this mentorship first come about, and how has this benefited your work? Kirsten, I'll turn to you first.
Hey, thanks a lot. So the Rural Water Supply Network has, as you say, introduced a new mentorship program. And I offered to be a mentor. Mm-hmm. And I really asked to have a woman to work with. As an engineer and in the field, I work with a lot of men, and also in drilling with a lot of men. So I really asked to work, to have paired up with a woman. Mm-hmm. And so Fadzai and I were paired up together. And to find a woman driller, a Zimbabwean woman drillers, whose name at first I could not pronounce at all, has just been, you know, it's been fantastic, really fantastic.
Yeah.
And we talk roughly every month, and we've gone over the official mentee time where we're still together, mentoring each other, co-mentoring. And for me, especially at the moment where I'm based in Europe after having worked many years in Africa, and I go in and out. But many things I love about the conversations with Fadzai, but for my own work, I get grounded.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm struggling with some guidance note, some training concept, and I explain it, and Fadzai helps to really ground me back. It's like I travel with her back to Zimbabwe or into Zimbabwe and contextualize it and think about things that are important, things about things that I haven't thought through. So among many things, I really appreciate the grounding, the sounding board of the realities,
mm-hmm.
for the things that I'm doing that are a little bit further away from the cutting edge of the field.
Yeah. Fadzai, your thoughts as well.
Okay, so how it actually started on my end is that I applied for a mentorship program because I was looking for something that was practical, that would give me more skills or more knowledge in the wash sector. And mentorship was a practical way to do that. So I received a positive response, and then I was paired with Kirsten. So when I found out she was an engineer, I was like, yeah, that's good, because I don't have an engineering background.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, yeah, this is really good for me. I will learn a lot from her. And to my surprise, it was much more than engineering. It was more, it was management. It was the technical aspects that I actually learned from Kirsten. So just simple innovations can actually come out of the conversations that we have. So the conversations that we have are more, they're not very formal. They're more informal, but it's an opportunity for each of us to learn. And I think the highlight of it was actually the birth of an innovation that we're still working on together, that is looking at WASH in our local context. So I think the mentorship program has really benefited in my work personally, in the innovation that I'm about to work on, and also organizationally, in that it has improved even my management and how I look at things, because I have that wisdom that comes from her as someone who's been in the sector for a while.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so brilliant that you two are both still in touch so regularly, even after the official deadline of the program. And I think it would be really interesting if this was implemented in other companies across the globe, because as you said, there's something so pertinent and so important about sharing your experiences with someone else from a different area or a different field of work. And I just think that's brilliant. In fact, it's improved both areas of work. It's just fantastic. So I just wanted to speak to you both about women empowerment as well within the industries you're working within. So as outlined within the Women Empowerment and Water Activities Guide, it's clear that the Rural Water Supply Network is making real efforts to empower women within their organisation. One of the factors mentioned within these activities the organisation is doing is community engagement and behaviour change communication. How do you feel that these two factors have been incorporated within your work? And Fadzai, I'll go to you first.
Thank you. There's a lot of behavior change communication that actually goes on in WASH, because there's a soft side of WASH. For example, there's community-based management of water points. So you're trying to make the water points sustainable, in that you then empower communities to be able to take care of their water resources through management and paying of subscriptions. And what is key is that we're trying to also ensure that women have roles that are important, like decision-making roles within the committees that manage water points. So that's also part of empowering women. And also the aspect of having water resources for women is an empowerment factor, in that they have more productive time, unlike spending so much time having to fetch water. The other aspect of behavior change communication that we have is through hygiene promotion and sanitation services. Mm-hmm. So for example, you're asking people to build toilets, and they're thinking, why do I need to build a toilet when the bush is there? So you're trying to walk through with them and be able to tell them of the challenges of actually having open defecation. What impact does it have on water resources, on their own health, on the health of their animals? So yeah, there's a lot of community engagement and behavior change communication that actually happens in, mm-hmm. in Zimbabwe and in WASH, in the WASH sector. Also, one thing that I would want to point out in terms of behavior change communication is the aspect of community-based management, in that in Zimbabwe, water has been free in the past, and being able to say to people, you know what, you actually need to pray for maintenance of these water resources, mm-hmm. is actually a big step in the, with the communities, as they are used to free water. So it requires a lot of skill and strategy to be able to do that behavior change communication.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And Kirsten, what are your thoughts on that as well?
I think one thing that the Rural Water Supply Network, especially in more recent times, has done is really making sure that there are more women presenting on its kind of knowledge sharing events, trying to get an equal balance, or as equal as possible, between men and women on panels. Not fully there yet, but doing very well. And some organizations are extremely well male dominated anyway. Certainly in for example, when I run training courses, I really push for at least 30% women on, and that's on practical drilling courses. And in one particular country that caused such a headache, great headache for the people I was working with, and they went to the university and pulled in women from the university who were studying geology to take part in these courses. So they weren't yet in the professionally working in the sector, but they were pulled in, and hopefully that will inspire them and keep them interested in the topic. Mm-hmm. And something that I never thought about when I was especially living and working in Uganda, until somebody pointed it out to me and said, you know, Kirsten, you're the only woman engineer working in the ministry. I was an advisor in the Ministry of Water and Environment. And don't forget, you're an inspiration to other women to see that a woman can be an engineer arguing with the male engineers. And so I think it's really important that we encourage women into engineering, into water supply, into management roles. I think us women have a role in supporting other women, bringing other women in, and also to not shy away from women's issues. So to talk about issues such as periods, you know, menstrual hygiene management, how women manage their menstruation, talking about menstruation in schools, you know, something I would have never said that word as a teenager, maybe to my close friends, but certainly never in the classroom. But to be able to utter those words, break the taboos of issues that are really important for women and for women's education. And also, I think really recognizing the issues that women face. And I come back to rural areas, you know, women who carry head loads of water or shoulder or arm loads of water, who face injury, who face potential disability. I think it's also important to really highlight those issues and use that to push for more investment to make sure that the people have water supplies at their home so that young people, the young fadzais of the future, don't have to walk to their neighbour's house to collect water or even further to fetch water. So a bit of a ramble there. But I think I certainly feel the older I get, I see how much more important it is. I think I was possibly as a woman in a male dominated field, as a young woman, probably I was just fighting for recognition without even realizing it, that I didn't have time to think about other women. Just, you know, that kind of somehow fight, not physical fight, but it's in hindsight that I realized that was probably there.
Yeah.
And now I realize the importance of pulling these other women up and in.
And I think the point you just touched upon there really links into what I was going to discuss next, in that, do you think there's already been successes or challenges highlighted by organizations such as Rural Water Supply Network in their efforts to empower women? As our previous podcast episodes have highlighted, it's so crucial to include women's voices within global climate negotiations, but also within these industries that you work in that are typically male dominated. So Kirsten, I'll come to you first. Do you think there has been clear successes or any challenges that you've seen personally as well?
I'm afraid I don't have the statistics or the analysis at my fingertips to give a good answer. And I think there's still a long way to go. There's groups that I'm involved with still now, which are people from different countries, from within Europe, from the US, from Africa, coming together. And there are still groups where I'm the only woman. Still, I think there's still actually an awful long way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's good having this conversation because it makes me think about the comment I made earlier, and maybe what we need to do is, if there are no women that can somehow be brought in from these organizations, is to pull in others, to pull in university students or to pull in young business leaders or whoever that's relevant. So I'm kind of back to challenging myself, really thinking, hang on a minute, that's not on. So how do we overcome that problem? So you've put a challenge back to me. Thank you.
And is this something that you'd maybe like to explore more in the future, being in empowerment and with more women?
Definitely. Yeah. I would. And I mean, it's great having this mentorship kind of co-mentee relationship with Fadza as another woman. Yeah, I would like to do more and show all that I could do, but certainly I've had a couple of ideas just from this call.
Yeah, brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. Fadza, what are your thoughts? Have you noticed any particular successes or challenges highlighted by organizations in their attempts and actions in empowering women?
Well, I wouldn't want to go far. I would want to actually say I'm a success myself, in that I've been part of the mentee program and I've been mentored by Kirsten. So I'm an example of the success of the organizations like the Rural Supply Water Supply Network. With Kirsten, she knows in the past I wouldn't really speak up in meetings. So I've been encouraged to actually speak up as a woman in meetings. So I actually consider myself as a success in the Rural Water Supply Network. And in terms of the challenges, I think it actually starts from the little girls being able to tell them that they can actually do this. If we're going to get toys, it's the trucks and everything that's related to that that goes to the boys. And then the girls, it's only the dollies. And they grow up thinking that's all they can do, and boys are the ones that deal with trucks. So I think it actually starts from a very young age to be able to say to women, you can do this at a very young age, and then they can actually take up some of those tasks that we consider to be men's tasks.
I think that's
or so men's fair. Fields.
Yeah, it's all about having those role models, but also not just waiting until we're adults to empower each other. Starting from when we're at school, when we're born, even as you said, the toys we're given, the colours we're associated with, they all have so much power in them. And I think we've underestimated how powerful they are for such a long time.
Yeah, maybe to also add, it's also about, I think Kirsten indicated this, it's also about woman to woman. So like how Kirsten has mentored me, I can see her as an engineer. So I think to myself, okay, if she's done it, then I can do it as well. So that woman to woman mentoring is very key to be able to have role models who are women who can inspire you to say, okay, if she has been able to do it, then I can do it as well.
I think by the sounds of it, this mentorship has been so successful in so many ways. And it's just so brilliant to meet you both and see you both together. It's just really making me feel empowered as well. Like, I just think it's amazing. Kirsten, sorry, was there anything that you wanted to add there?
I mean, I feel with what I call co-mentee, I feel it's just at the beginning that we're kind of starting. Actually, you know, I think there's so much that we can still continue to do and inspire each other to do and reflect on and push and encourage each other. So I'm so happy to have found such a wonderful person to co-mentee with. It's really such a pleasure. And just thinking back, this kind of doesn't fit neatly in the row of podcast things. I think, I mean, it's when I was at school, we chose subjects in our third year at secondary school. And I, first of all, chose economics and absolutely hated it, really hated it. It drove me kind of mad. And there was an engineering topic in that thing. There was different topics in that column, as they called it. So I asked to switch out of economics and into engineering. I was 14. And it was a fight, you know, really, because there were only boys in that engineering class. There were only actually, I think, five boys. Mm-hmm. And it was a real fight. I really had to fight to be able to take that subject. But it was an argument. Mm-hmm. But I moved into it and have never looked back. So going into engineering started with an argument when I was 14 at school. So I think it's important for women who want to try doing something which is a little bit different, which is not the stereotype, mm-hmm. to be encouraged, to be brave enough. You know, and that sometimes is a bit of encouragement. And I certainly had support from my family to make that choice.
I think bravery is such a key word you use there. It is sad that so much what revolves around this is women being brave to do something different, but it's so important. And I think with things like the mentorship program, it is that support from other women that makes the most difference. That was my last question today, but I just wanted to thank you both for joining me. This has been an excellent conversation. I feel like I've learned so much from both of you, and it makes me so happy that you're both still in contact as well. Is there any final comments or questions you'd like to ask before we finish this episode? No problem. Thank you both and have a really lovely day.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Grace.
Thanks, Grace, for your wonderful preparations and interviewing. You really have a skill set already that's well developed, putting us at ease. So thank you for really doing an amazing job. Fantastic.
Thank you.